VPR's commentary series began in 1988. And we hosted our first commentary brunch, we think. Ty and I made a quick check through the files, we think, in 2006. So this is our 27th year of production and our 9th annual brunch gathering. Preparation for the brunch begins soon after the first of the year. This is mostly work done by the formidable Ty, but I get to help. She makes a list of all the commentators who've had commentaries aired during the previous 12 months or so. And this year, this surprised me. We came up with a grand total of 84 individual names. I was thinking we were working with somewhere around 50 people. We are now working with something like 84. So, if we don't want the brunch to last all night, we can't possibly invite everyone. But it's so hard to choose that we instead rank the names according to commentary volume. And those commentators who've accumulated the most airtime in the designated period are invited first. Then, depending on acceptances and regrets, we work our way down the list until we reach our limit of 25 or so participants. So every brunch is really just a sampler of the commentary series as a whole. And every year is different, mostly because the list itself keeps changing. Every year we add new voices. Every year we have a few people who take a break in favor of other commitments, professional, family. They're going to be gone for a while. Some return. Some move away, and if you don't live here, at least part-time, then you can't be a commentator. And to some, we have to say a more permanent goodbye, sadly enough, like Cheryl Hanna and Jeff Shields, both of whom left us last year. And if you attended last year's brunch, you probably heard Cheryl Hanna deliver a wonderful essay at that time. How fortunate we were to have counted them as commentators and others. How lucky we were to have been the recipients of their considerable wisdom, wit, and humor so many times. And how nice it is to be together again today for this annual celebration of community, creative writing, original writing, creativity in general, storytelling, authentic voices, and public service, all of which are hallmarks of commentaries at VPR. This year's theme is Nothing Ventured, and with 26 different commentators present, we have 26 different interpretations of the theme. Personally, I'm hoping for lots of stories about flying leaps in risky business. But before we get started, let me just mention a couple of little housekeeping details. First, a reminder that in order to reduce the chance of minor distractions, our stellar Lake Maury Inn waitstaff will not be tending tables during the readings. And second, please turn off your cell phones, since this event is being recorded for possible broadcast later this year by our intrepid production engineer, Chris Albertine. That's also why you may hear an occasional line retake, especially if a word or a phrase trips us up. This is standard procedure in the recording studio and allows us to edit the audio as needed. And as has been our custom for the last couple of brunches, we're once again presenting in reverse alpha order in five groups. I'll invite each group in turn to assemble collectively here by the podium, and then each presenter will speak in the order indicated in the program. And commentators, for the sake of recording, please give your name and the title of your piece before you begin. Then take a little pause and then launch. First up is Group A, which in true VPR commentator brunch style begins with W. Our first group includes Chris Wren, Bill Schubart, Suzanne Spencer-Rendell, Martha Molnar, Abigail Mnookin, and Tim McQuiston. You'll join us up here, please.
My name is Chris Wren, and my title is Tomcat. I hope there's some cat people here. The uninvited guest arrived in time for lunch at Jacqueline's garden party and headed straight for the salmon salad. "You've got a great cat here," a friend said as he fed the intruder a morsel of salmon. "That is not my cat," I said. I'd never seen a little tomcat this scrawny. He must have been abandoned somewhere along our dirt road. But we already owned two cats and didn't need a third. What I always wanted was a dog. "The cat can't stay," my wife agreed. "Let me feed him, and then he'll have to go." Jacqueline opened several cans of Fancy Feast and set the bowls out on our back porch. But the cat came back. Nothing ventured, nothing gained for this little guy, and he curled up on the porch. We couldn't let him in the house, but I worried he'd end up as roadkill. So I stuffed a towel into a basket for him to sleep outside. He meowed at me through the window. Jacqueline opened another can of Fancy Feast. "We could use a barn cat," I said. "Let him live in the barn." "No way." Before the week was over, he'd charmed his way upstairs to our bedroom. This little bundle of gray fur with tufted ears and big white paws like a bobcat, but for his elegant tail and exuberant purr. He's still here. Every night he heads out to catch us mice for breakfast. He's a natural hunter, once plunging into the tall grass to haul back a wild turkey. He comes in after midnight soaked with rain and demands a rub down with my towel. When I drive home, he leaps under the windshield of my pickup and greets me upside down. If I go for a walk, he trots alongside. "Go home," I tell him, and he does. In winter, he bounds through snow or slides on the icy driveway. In summer, we race each other around the pasture. I found the companionship of the dog I wanted. He just happens to look like a cat.
There's a theme here. My name is Bill Schubart, and it's good to be with you. And this is called Let the Kids Decide. I'm not obsessive about pet names. I usually leave them to the kids, perhaps with a little parental guidance, like avoiding undistinguished names like Fluffy or Spot, or ambiguous names like Pussy, or aggressive names like Genghis or Trojan. So when we drove up to the farmhouse in Starksboro to choose a tiger kitten from the dwindling array of barn cats left after an onslaught of fishers had depleted the neighborhood of most domestic pets under 40 pounds, we decided on a double-toed tiger male and brought him home in the arms of my then 5-year-old daughter, Anna. Looking small and confused on the floor of our kitchen, the still nameless kitten relieved himself mightily. I muttered under my breath, "Ought to call him Sphincter." "What's that?" Anna chirped. Now, with children, parental duty demands honest and forthright answers, which I delicately provided. Anna and her slightly older brother, Steve, were delighted with their new vocabulary edition, which neither could pronounce, so our new kitty was henceforth known as Finkster. Luckily, I remembered from the legion of domestic house cats we'd had since I was Anna's age that Finkster would need shots. I made an appointment with the local vet, and to imbue my children with a sense of responsibility for their new pet, told them they were to accompany Finkster to the vet. I drive and answer any questions they couldn't. The avuncular vet knew the drill. He bent down over his computer keyboard to meet Anna's smile as she held Finkster in her arms, and he asked, "What's your kitty's name?" To my embarrassment and his astonishment, Anna answered clearly, "Sphincter." The vet blinked and looked at me quizzically, as if wondering whether to call the authorities. I simply nodded as he carefully hunt-and-pecked the word into his computer. After a terse lecture on the prevalence of feral predators and a futile effort to sell us overpriced cat food, I drove home with the children in the back seat, taking turns comforting their wounded pet. The following year, a blue, computer-generated merge-purge postcard arrived from the vet that read, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Schubart, it's time to bring your sphincter in for a rabies shot."
Hi, I'm Suzanne Spencer-Rendall, and my piece is titled Venturing Outdoors. My early childhood on a tiny island in Washington State's Puget Sound during the 1970s was idyllic. Spending countless hours exploring tide pools on the beach, picking wild blackberries, and feeding the family's chickens. Just in time for the materialistic 1980s, we moved to suburban Connecticut and somehow traded the outdoors for the mall. As soon as I could, I ran back to more rural surroundings. Now I'm raising two children in an age of instant digital gratification, in which content and contentment are increasingly at odds. A recent Kaiser Family Foundation study found that kids spend an average of 45 hours a week plugged into some type of electronic device. So I've encouraged my kids to venture outdoors, into the garden, up trees, and along our 200-year-old rock wall. We admire the apple blossoms on our trees in May and note bees flying back and forth. We patiently watch the remnants of blossoms grow through the summer into apples and wait for them to ripen in the fall. My children see that, like us, those trees need water to live, not too little, not too much. We talk about how the leaves use sunlight and carbon dioxide to grow the apples we eat and to produce oxygen we breathe. Every August, my kids wander down rows of bushes at a blueberry farm near our home, picking blueberries with friends and staining their faces blue as they fill their stomachs, all without Wi-Fi. If we're bored, we go hiking. Scrapes, bug bites, and tired muscles are the price we pay for admission to a cathedral of mountains and trees. Eventually, my kids may still find their way to suburban or city living. But if they do, they'll know there are wild, unplugged places waiting for them to venture into again. And as their generation faces the unprecedented challenge of climate change, they'll know that nature isn't just an app to be instantly downloaded, and that solutions can't always be streamed.
My name is Martha Molnar, and my piece is Nothing Ventureth, Something Gained. Monday morning is my time to sit in front of the screen and get serious, to cross at least two items off the list and do it in record time, leaving the afternoon for the neglected garden. But first, I take my coffee outside to watch the sunrise. It may be June, but yesterday was more like March, and tomorrow it may feel like July. An immense red sun skirts the top of our mountain. The cushion is already warm. It's too bright to read, so I sit with my eyes closed and listen to the birds. They carry on as if this were the first sunrise in the history of the world. I agree that it might as well be. The sun turns gold, the air warms up. My cup is empty. Yesterday's paper is yellowing in my lap. The list threatens, but only remotely. And still, I sit. Eventually, I go inside, but only to get a drink so I can continue to sit and do nothing. The phone rings and I ignore it. The cell phone sounds. I ignore that too. A lifelong overachiever, I start justifying this unusual laziness. I recall an interview with a high-powered executive about to retire. Asked what more she planned to do with her free time, She answered that she wanted to do less, much less. Worth a try, I think, remembering brilliant ideas that came to brilliant people while they were doing nothing. From Archimedes soaking in his tub to Newton idling under a tree. As the sun rises higher, I open my eyes and see the maple doing its silent work, unmoving, and the grass, so potent and yet so still. Italian painter Giorgio Vasari noted that men of genius sometimes accomplish most when they work least. I sit in warm inertia, silently growing roots, and decide that I myself may never accomplish another thing. Instead, I'll practice doing nothing until I get really, really good at it. Then I'll write a book on the art of doing nothing.
My name is Abigail Manukin, and my piece is entitled The Sabbath. My wife and I don't check our email on Saturdays as a symbolic yet meaningful observance of the Jewish Sabbath. We're not very religious, but the tradition of a Sabbath, a day of rest from work, appeals to both of us. Our days and weeks as working mothers fill up quickly, fulfilling professional tasks and deadlines, parenting a toddler, maintaining a home and garden, walking the dog, exercising, going to appointments, attending board meetings, and, when I'm lucky, finding time to write. In most cases, these activities involve email. Lots and lots of emails, as we juggle schedules and manage logistics. Usually, life feels very busy. The Japanese characters for busy are heart and death, as in death of the heart. And while this might seem extreme, I can certainly relate to feeling overly burdened at times by places I have to go and things I have to do. So every Saturday, we take a small break and opt out of email communication. Technology, including cell phones and computers, hasn't been eliminated yet. But even a refuge from email provides much-needed breathing space and time to nurture each other and ourselves. At the beginning of the school year last fall, part of my wife's professional development involved discussing with colleagues the importance of taking a break from their work as teachers. They received a collection of poems and writings about the Sabbath, which my wife shared with me. One excerpt by Maya Angelou reads, "Every person needs to take one day away to withdraw from the cares which will not withdraw from us." And another excerpt by Wayne Muller declares, "Sabbath is more than the absence of work. It is the presence of something that arises when we consecrate a period of time to what is most deeply beautiful, nourishing, and true." Perhaps what began as no email on Saturdays will morph into a deeper observance of the Sabbath for my family and me. I've already learned that sometimes when nothing is ventured, everything is gained.
I'm Timothy McQuiston. I'm the editor of Vermont Business Magazine and VermontBiz.com. And this piece is called Risking More Than Everything, Your Reputation. Imagine losing $114 million in one day. Another $38 million in the next few months and being removed as the leader of the company you founded 30 years ago as a simple coffee shop and built into a global company with a market cap of $13 billion. Now imagine being kicked off the board entirely. Perhaps worse is the scorn of your own peers. Despite all the good you've done and the tens of millions you've given to many organizations. And then, over-leveraged against the stock in your company, there's an outside chance, as the stock price collapses, that you could be financially ruined. This isn't entirely your fault, except for maybe investing in Krispy Kreme donuts. Consumers are looking for healthier options, and donuts are not that, nor are they high margin. Even at Dunkin' Donuts, fancy sandwiches and dark roast iced coffee are driving the business these days. And this is your retirement gig, because you were only in your 30s when you made your first fortune, before discovering that great cup of coffee after skiing at Sugarbush in 1981. Robert Stiller was able to look around the corner, as Starbucks did, and understand that high-end coffee was the future of the market. That was Bob Stiller's first moment of genius. His second was the K-Cup. And while he didn't invent the Keurig single-cup coffee maker, he understood how valuable the concept was. By brewing coffee under pressure in a single-serve pod, anyone could get a great cup of coffee at home or at work. Stiller made the Forbes magazine billionaires list in the fall of 2011, just before his financial and personal success unraveled. But his story may still have a happy ending. The steep rise of Keurig stock in the last 3 years has put him back on the Forbes list. Building an empire, even once, requires two things which are hard to come by: genius and dumb luck. If you already had made it, would you roll the dice again? Some do, and that's what it's all about.
All right, thank you very much. Now we invite to the podium Mary McCallum, Mike Martin, Bill Mayers, Don Kreese, Susan Cook Kittredge.
I'm Mary McCallum, and the name of my piece is The Chicken War. 30 years ago, I left my university career and moved to Vermont for love. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, I thought, as I ditched suburbia for life in a drafty farmhouse and embraced it all: wood stacking, gardening, canning, mowing, and chickens. I loved caring for our small flock of aging biddies. They supplied us with eggs and demanded little in return. Often, on hot summer afternoons, I'd work outside at my portable typewriter on a small table near the hen house. Gentle cluckings formed a counterpoint to my tapping. It was downright idyllic, until my boyfriend took up with another woman. So I moved in with some neighbors on a farm up the road. They had a vacant coop. And when someone casually mentioned they'd like some hens, I said I thought I knew where we could get some. And so the great chicken war began, on the day a friend and I snuck over to my ex's place while he was at work, and we filled some pillowcases with unsuspecting hens. Not wanting to be greedy, we left him the rooster. That night, my ex called, furious. "Do you know where the chickens are?" he demanded. "They're here," I said cheerily, explaining that because I'd been their caretaker, the hens belonged with me. "But we left you the rooster," I added. He hung up, and I savored my moment of sweet revenge. All went well until the hens stopped laying that fall, and my thrifty Vermont friends declared that if the hens weren't earning their keep, they had to go, unless I wanted to pay for their feed. So out came the pillowcases once again, and my accomplice and I orchestrated a chicken heist in reverse, returning the confused but compliant hens to their old coop. The rooster was overjoyed to see them. That night, my ex called, again furious. "Why are they back?" he shouted into the phone. "They're not laying, and I have to pay for chicken feed all winter." "They've missed you," I said sweetly. And the rooster. Eventually, the hens started laying again. The rooster was happy. And I had both ventured a little and gained a lot. I was now quite experienced in matters of love, war, fairness, and chickens.
My name is Michael Martin, and the name of this piece is Magali. My French father-in-law used to say you could parachute my wife, Magali, into the desert with two matches and a penknife, and she'd come out just fine. High praise from a man who served as a paratrooper in the Sahara during the Algerian War, but if you met my wife, you'd probably agree. To be sure, she's beautiful, but she's also resourceful, resilient, and fearless. We met and fell in love in Paris when I was a grad student, and when I had to return home, I asked her to come with me. To my surprise, she said yes, packed some belongings, said goodbye to her family, and flew to a country she knew little of, only that it was the home of Marilyn Monroe, the Puritans, and Lou Reed. It was challenging at first. There was a recession on, so we had to wait tables in a Chinese restaurant where she learned English from Hong Kong cooks who grew up in the Bronx. One customer said her accent was wrong for the place. And didn't her country have that tower that leaned over? No, that's Pisa, not Paris, she told him. Whatever, same difference, he replied. Megali's English spelling and grammar is now better than most Americans, but she's had to work at it. It wasn't easy for her to land here in her mid-20s and learn a bunch of new sounds and foreign names. She used to call a famous Vermont ice cream Tom and Jerry's. And even now when she says sheet and beach, people wonder if she's swearing or just talking about vacation. And it's still hard to always be seen as the French girl when you're your own woman with your own ideas. In fact, this is what all immigrants face. But we sometimes forget that immigration is what made our country great. You know, give us your resourceful, your resilient, your fearless. Give us the people who bravely take a leap into the unknown.
I'm Bill Mayers, and this is called Sheer Presumption. In my 20s, after three professional failures, I fell into photojournalism, which captivated me. I made steady, if slow, progress, and my former, probably excessive, ambitions were rekindled. But my dream job at the National Geographic was remote, and winning a Pulitzer Prize was the Everest of hubris. Maybe I could write a book. I did know something about Marine Corps boot camp, having gone through Paris Island right after college. The Vietnam War was in full cry. Some publisher ought to be interested in a book about training troops for that quagmire. So I wrote to Marine Corps headquarters at the Pentagon to ask permission. In a couple of weeks, they wrote back to say yes, provided that the Corps could review my photos. That was okay with me. Thus, in the summer of 1968, I spent 12 weeks following a platoon of recruits through their training 12 to 15 hours a day. I stayed in the BOQ, the Bachelor Officer Quarters, but I was with the platoon from Reveille to Taps. By the end, I had over 7,000 negatives, but when I offered to show them to the Marine Corps, they said, "We trust you." My girlfriend at the time persuaded me to write a 12,000-word text to accompany the projected 150 to 200 photographs. A buddy from my own Marine platoon who worked for the publisher Doubleday and Company introduced me to their military editor. After a protracted correspondence, they bought the book. With that imprimatur, I walked into the Art Institute of Chicago with a portfolio of prints and asked the curator of photography if he'd like to do a show. He said yes. My final coup was to persuade former Marine Commandant and Medal of Honor winner David Shoup to write the foreword. The book ultimately sold 25,000 copies and received critical approval in newspapers that ranged from the conservative San Diego Times-Union to the underground East Village Other. I still pinch myself at the presumption of it all.
Hello, everybody. My name is Donald Kreese, and accessing my inner Cheryl Hanna, my commentary is entitled 6,000 Days. Justice Kennedy fretted about the thousands of years that marriage has meant a union of one man and one woman. But as I sat there in the U.S. Supreme Court on April 28th, I found myself thinking about the thousands of days, 6,004 to be exact, between the hearing in Washington and the almost identical oral argument I had attended in 1998 before the Vermont Supreme Court. In 2015, the question is whether the U.S. Constitution requires marriage to be available to gay people and straight people alike. 17 years ago, the question was the same, but the text was the Vermont Constitution. In both cases, the legal standard is simple. The state had to show some rational relationship between a ban on same-gender marriage and a legitimate government interest. What was striking in 1998 was how the lawyers for the Vermont Attorney General just couldn't come up with any such rational relationship, a reason that wasn't grounded in ignorance or prejudice. More than 6,000 days later, the lawyer for Michigan was just as helpless. His pitch? If we let gay people get married, straight people will stop associating marriage with procreation, and more kids will be born out of wedlock. That was the best he could do. Still, he had to say something to the justices, and well, nothing ventured, nothing gained. But my award for courage goes to the people I happen to be sitting behind in both oral arguments, the plaintiffs, same-gender couples, who refused to take no for an answer from states with irrational prejudices. A couple of rows behind me sat a person with a different sort of audacity. He leapt up and yelled that homosexuality is an abomination. Security guards hustled him away. But the Supreme Court has an echoey building, and you could hear him screaming for a long time, his voice getting fainter and fainter. And it continues to grow fainter with each passing day.
I'm Susan Cook Kittredge, and this is Both Ends Against the Middle. I recently watched an old episode of Masterpiece Theater and was struck by how settled and confident my father seemed when he did the introduction. One might easily assume that his life had been a progression of entitled accomplishments, that in some way he had been to the manor born. This was not the case. His parents were decidedly lower class. In Blackpool, England, my grandfather was an iron fitter and a Methodist lay preacher. My grandmother ran a boarding house. But Daddy was energetic and curious, and through spunk and determination was awarded a scholarship to Cambridge and later fellowships to Yale and Harvard. Never was his rank gumption more apparent than on his first trip to California in 1933. He had recently applied to the London Observer and the BBC to be their film critic. They'd quickly dismissed this 23-year-old upstart. He then decided to do something at best risky and at worst dishonest. He wrote to Charlie Chaplin, then undoubtedly the most famous person in the world, and he told them that he was from the Observer. Now, technically, I suppose that you could say that he was from the Observer in the sense that he had indeed been sent away. By some quirk of fate, their shared British heritage or infatuation with America, Chaplin agreed to see him. Arriving at his door, my father inquired if Chaplin would be willing to do an interview, and after a chipper meeting, Chaplin agreed. Daddy immediately rose, excused himself, and in a Clark Kent to Superman move, fled to the nearest phone booth. He called the Observer, told them that he'd just secured an interview with Charlie Chaplin, and asked if they might like to reconsider their earlier dismissal. He was hired on the spot
and spent the next two summers with Charlie Chaplin. With the success of this encounter, he launched a career of taking risks and faking it until he did actually become the person he aspired to be.
Oh, thank you. Our next group includes John Kalacki, Sarwar Kashmiri, Henry Hohmeyer, Evangelina Holvino, and Darren Higgins.
I'm John Kalacki, and the name of my piece is Post-Concussion Syndrome. What happened? I asked. They replied that I fell out of the cart that my pony was pulling and was knocked unconscious. Minutes later, I asked again, what happened? And this loop continued as my husband picked me up at the barn and took me to the hospital. But I don't remember any of this. 2 hours in the ER, then a scan of my brain was taken. I don't recall having it done, but the report said it was clear. I was sent home with post-concussion instructions to rest in darkened rooms, not watch TV or read, no computers either, and seek counseling to deal with the residual stress from the accident. The right side of my lower body was black and blue. My vision was blurred and extremely light sensitive. All I wanted to do was sleep. When I went back to work, it was in sunglasses and the office lights dimmed. My doctor sent me to an ophthalmologist, a brain trauma specialist, and a craniosacral therapist. All were encouraging a full recovery, but I was dispirited. 2 months post-injury, and my eyesight was still fuzzy. Horse buddies pitched in to help exercise the pony. She had no ill effects from the mishap and was eager to work. I, however, was afraid. Although I'd driven her hundreds of times in the past 4 years, PTSD kicked in. My fear was palpable. I felt out of control and didn't want to re-injure my head with another fall. So we started slowly, groundwork first, and then short drills with another driver with me in the cart. Sometimes the pony picked up on my nerves and became agitated herself, further escalating my own anxiety. We try to work through this and finish up on a calm and positive note. Eventually, I transitioned to being alone in the cart with coaching from the ground. Goals were modest. Achieve small victories. We went back to the basics. Incrementally, I regained confidence and trust in our relationship. While things aren't completely back to normal yet, I'm happy to report that every time I'm in the driver's seat, I enjoy my pony more.
Betty, I want to take 15 seconds of my time to say, you know, how lucky we are at VPR. We live where we can hear VPR, where we have commentaries. Not many people do that. And I know I speak for all the commentators that I haven't recorded one commentary with Betty where I have not learned something new. So I just wanted to say thank you. So this commentary is called Magical Moving Stairs, and I'm Sarwar Kashmiri. Picture a boy on a journey standing in front of a magical set of stairs that moves upwards towards the ceiling. The boy wants to go from the floor he's on to the next one, but he's faced with a quandary he's never before encountered, which is how to get on stairs that move. It is a quandary the boy must resolve if he is to continue his journey. So he tells himself there must be a way to master this challenge. He considers jumping on with both feet and catching the railings with both hands, or jumping on with one foot while holding on to the railing with the opposite hand. He considers that the secret might be to lean forward when he jumps, But then again, one might slip, so perhaps the secret would be to jump on with one foot on a stair and the other on the next stair and bend forward to balance. All this the poor boy ponders alone at Zagreb Airport in Czechoslovakia as he contemplates his first ever escalator. And then there is a remarkable development. A considerably older woman strolls up to the escalator, walks on effortlessly, and is whisked up, up, and away, all the while reading a newspaper. Picture the smile on the boy's face as he says, "Aha, that's how it's done." And a young Sarwar Kashmiri, just out of India, pretending he's done this for his whole life, follows the example of the lady, albeit a little unsteadily. When he gets to the top, he turns right around, comes back down again, and then victoriously up once more. I had been a bit apprehensive about leaving my parents and my country for the first time to begin my journey in life, but after meeting the challenge of the magically moving stairs, the future seemed considerably less frightening. "Bring it on," I might have said to the gods of fate if I'd known the phrase. Nothing ventured, nothing gained.
I'm Henry Hohmeyer, and my piece is just called Nothing Ventured. When I was a young man, I thought nothing of taking risks. I body surfed after a hurricane and nearly drowned. I taught school in the ghetto of Jersey City and lived in the neighborhood, the only teacher, black or white, who dared to do so. I hitchhiked across the Sahara. I joined the Peace Corps. I figured I had to take risks if I wanted to experience life to the fullest. But now I've started my seventh decade of life, and I'm more cautious. I'm not to the point where taking a risk is buying the hot salsa instead of the medium. But I no longer need to prove anything to myself or anyone else. I like that feeling. Maybe it means I've finally grown up. Now many of the risks I take with plants. I'm a gardening guy, and I suppose I should really live in a place like New Jersey, the gardening state, where the climate is better for tender perennials and exotic trees and shrubs. A place where I don't have to protect delicate plants against winters like this past one that killed several favorites of mine, including a gnarled and aging mountain laurel. I knew when I bought the laurel that our climate might do it in, but was willing to take the risk and dedicate the space for it. It'll live for 20 years. But I love where I live, and I'm not willing to venture a move. And the tedium of waiting in traffic down there might put me in an early grave, something that riding a motorcycle on slick, muddy roads of West Africa never did. When I was in Paris last, my partner Cindy discovered a restaurant that served its customers in total darkness. The waitstaff is blind, leading eaters to their tables and serving mystery dishes. We didn't end up eating there, but now I wish we had. Nothing ventured, nothing gained after all. Maybe we'll go there next trip. I want to keep on taking a few risks. And so what if I spill soup on my shirt?
I'm Evangeline Olvino, and my piece is called Dead Dictum. Nothing ventured, nothing gained is a proverb that does not translate well into Spanish. In Puerto Rico, you might say, si no te arriesgas, te jodes. Or in other words, nothing ventured, you're doomed. Through Puerto Rican cultural eyes, the saying is too optimistic with a capitalist flavor. At a basic level, the proverb doesn't make sense to me because with every step and every breath we take, we venture into uncertainty. But not all risk leads to gain, and not all actions are motivated by gain. I suggest that the most important accomplishments in life are achieved not because of the desire for gain, but because we feel compelled to do something. So I think reality is more like my Puerto Rican version of the saying. And clearly, there are times when we should not venture forth, such as when we need to relax, smell the flowers, or stay put. For example, many of us understand that the end of life may be a time better spent in hospice care rather than venturing into the realm of heroic medical measures. Also, judgments about risks and gain get complicated when we consider from whose perspective to assess the gains. From the point of view of the 15th century Spanish monarchs, Columbus venturing to the New World produced enormous riches for the crown. But these gains were achieved at the expense of the Native American people and their civilizations. So in the nothing venture, nothing gained game, the odds can be unfairly stacked. Finally, we need to consider that risks and gains for individuals are not the same as those for society. So while a few private companies are making a great deal of money from today's prison industrial complex, our society is losing millions of lives by not investing in alternative solutions to the social justice problems of our time. With a little help from our multicultural friends, I recommend we reconsider the wisdom of taken for granted proverbs like this one.
Hi, I'm Darren Higgins, and this is called Learning to Say Yes. The world is full of emptiness and horror, unfairness and injustice, and so much beauty and love that it will break your heart. We have nothing but time here, nothing but time running out, nothing but time to worry about not having enough time. It all begins to blur, time and timelessness, emptiness and fullness. It's hard to know what to do or what to say. I'm reminded of what the brilliant Vermont poet Mary Ruffel writes in her essay, On Beginnings. We each really only speak one sentence in our lifetime. For some reason, I imagine my sentence slowly filling endless reams of paper as the obsolete 1980s sound of a dot matrix printer echoes the distant rooms of my childhood home. If I could read it, if I could examine it, how often would I find the word no? There's no reason not to be honest here among friends, fellow strugglers with words, sufferers, and worshipers of words. I almost said no today because I am, because we are, too often bound by fear, by dread. 7 years ago, when my first son was born, I had to decide how to answer the wails that announced the start of his own sentence and disturbed the muffled quiet of his world. Would I say no to him? Could I look into his wild, seeking eyes and say no? His birth is where my yes began, and the ferocious love his mother has for him, for his baby brother, for me, sustains my belief in yes, my ability to say yes. Now, before fears can rally and rush the no to my throat and tongue, I say yes. Sometimes I have to trap it with my teeth. Yes, I say quickly, yes. This world is full of emptiness and horror, unfairness and injustice, and so much beauty and love that it will break your heart. I have only this one sentence, and I'm trying to say yes to it all.
Our next group includes Vic Henningsen, Barry Dunsmore, Ben Doyle, Leora Dowling, and Dennis Delaney.
I'm Vic Henningsen, and this is today's lesson. Nothing ventured is the first half of a popular saying that's been variously attributed to Gilbert and Sullivan, Benjamin Franklin, and Geoffrey Chaucer. But it's actually one of many English country sayings, painstakingly transcribed by the scholar John Heywood, one of those delightful English eccentrics without whose obsessive preoccupations our lives would be much poorer. In the 16th century, he preserved the rustic wisdom of those Gertrude Stein later called village explainers. Excellent, she continued, if you were a village, but if you were not, not. Well, you're not a village, but you are a captive audience. So I give you the lesson for today, taking my text from Heywood's Proverbs, published in 1546. As he would say, not venture, not won. But the fat's in the fire, and we must make hay while the sun shines. Haste makes waste, they say, but time and tide wait for no man. With a new broom, we'll make a clean sweep. After all, nothing's impossible if we hold our noses to the grindstone, if we understand that we can lead a horse to water but can't make him drink, and if we remember to avoid robbing Peter to pay Paul. But Rome wasn't built in a day, and beggars can't be choosers. After all, half a loaf is better than none. Therefore, we must avoid missing the forest for the trees. So let's not put the cart before the horse, and let's avoid buying a pig and a poke. Rather, let's make sure to hit the nail on the head. After all, one good turn deserves another. I know two heads are better than one, and many hands make light work, but every dog must have his day, and this is mine. Perhaps I should have looked before I leaped, but as it is, I've shot my bolt. It may sound like butter wouldn't melt in my mouth, and it certainly looks like I'm trying to have my cake and eat it too, but the more the merrier. And clearly, if you give me an inch, I'll take a mile. Still, there's no fool like an old fool, and all's well that ends well.
There's more erudition there in that one report than everything else we're talking about today, right? I'm Barry Dunsmore. And this is a story of the young Dunsmore in Arabia. In February 1967, in the bar at the Saint George Hotel in Beirut, which then was the most elegant watering hole in all of the Middle East, the talk was all about reports that Egypt had bombed obscure villages in northern Yemen with poison gas. Since 1962, Egypt and Saudi Arabia had been at war in Yemen in a struggle for the future leadership of the Arab world between leftist revolutionaries like Nasser and ultra-conservative traditional monarchies, a contest which Egypt ultimately lost. The way to royalist Yemen was through Saudi Arabia, which normally was closed to journalists. However, rumor had it that the Saudis might issue visas at the airport in Jeddah. So I cabled my bosses in New York of my intention to try to get to Yemen, explaining that I had to leave immediately and I could not wait for their approval. After about a week in Jeddah, my crew and I were put on an old DC-3 and dropped in the desert near the Yemen border. After several hours of sitting there, looking in all directions, we spotted a small dust cloud on the horizon. It wasn't Omar Sharif on a camel, but it was a new Pontiac with huge tires driven by a Saudi prince who had just graduated from UCLA. The next morning, after an Egyptian bombing raid did hit our oasis but did little damage, we began our trek into Yemen with a dozen Yemeni guides, several donkeys, and a camel. Even in winter, temperatures exceeded 100 degrees during the day, and it was freezing at night. The camel carrying our television equipment died while crossing the 6,000-foot mountain range. Days later, Kataf, the place we were looking for, finally appeared on the horizon, its mud brick towers stretching above thorny trees. Up close, it was right out of the Middle Ages. During a welcoming sheep's eyes feast, villagers vividly described the choking gas attack. Afterwards, they showed us roughly 100 new graves, bomb craters, and the unmarked carcasses of camels, sheep, and dogs littering the alleys of the town. Their stories were touching and credible, and an international investigation later confirmed, based on lung tissue biopsies, that poison gas had indeed been used in Kataf. Now, we had been out of touch for about a month when we returned to Beirut. Our families were worried sick, and I completely understood their concerns. Yet I knew that I was on a career path in which the adage, nothing ventured, nothing gained, would become an absolute truth. Thank you.
My name's Ben Doyle, and my commentary is entitled, Even the Losers. At 12, I was bad enough at baseball that my dad paid me $20 to quit. As a father now myself, I recognize that this was an unorthodox parenting strategy. Parents should always encourage their children to venture forth and reach for the stars. But Dad liked to keep it real, and he suggested I reach for something more within my grasp, like musical theater or stamp collecting. It was probably the right move. I was miserable at practice, despondent after games. I couldn't hit, couldn't field, and the team certainly couldn't win. So Dad, who didn't have a ton of extra cash, bribed me to move on. And I did. Or I thought I did. 15 years later, while living in Manhattan, I came to the realization that I needed to revisit my team sports trauma. In college, my wife had played soccer, basketball, and rugby. My male friends pontificated about the glory found on the football and lacrosse fields. But no one was impressed with my references to the loneliness of the long-distance runner or recitations of A.E. Housman's poem to an athlete, Dying Young. In a culture obsessed with athletics, to say, I stink at sports, feels akin to admitting you're a communist or that you prefer French fries over freedom fries. I realized the only solution was intensive therapy or slow pitch softball. Softball was cheaper. Through a friend of a friend, I found a position playing right field on the Red Cross September 11th Recovery Project slow pitch softball team. Sure, there were some players with real game. Third baseman Frank Favilla almost hit a home run once. But most of the team was like me, klutzes, seeking redemption. I played hard, even tore a hamstring, and I gained something, joy. Joy that I'd never found on the Little League team where the coach screamed at us, only the stars got to play, and soda was for winners. After a slow pitch game, everybody went out for beer and a good time, even the losers.
Good afternoon. I'm Leora Dowling, and this is Letting Go. By now, you know the old saying, nothing ventured, nothing gained. But wouldn't it be lovely if when we tried something new, we could feel like we didn't have to risk losing in order to win? I don't mind gambling a little with tangible things like money or material goods, but what most of us are least willing to risk is something intangible. The ego, and its cohorts, pride, shame, and fear. The thing we're most afraid to lose is our well-cultivated, all-grown-up sense of self, our intelligence, attractiveness, and aptitude. We're afraid of being judged as stupid, silly, klutzy, old, or inept. Ego is what stops some of us from getting on a carousel, taking tennis lessons, or auditioning for community theater. Persuasive, ego-based fear keeps us from enrolling in college courses, creative writing groups, or from speaking up at town meeting. Ironically, our ego works against our creativity, desires, and fulfillment. For example, no matter how hot it gets during a Vermont summer, I never go swimming because I haven't worn a bathing suit in public in 20 years. I'd like to go swimming, but I can't seem to get beyond the mere thought of silent ridicule. It's pitiful when imagining what people I don't even know will be thinking about me gets in the way of my having fun, and sadder still that what I think of me does too. Ego trumps the pleasure of feeling cool water on my hot skin. Pride refuses to let me splash and laugh like I used to, despite a few extra pounds. Shame gets in the way of my comfort and freedom. If we want to go about reducing the power of ego, honest self-examination, often through meditation and the counsel of wise friends, can help begin the process. Knowledge reduces irrational fear, and a sense of humor also helps. Of course, in the end, it's time and practice that bring about real change, real freedom. So, this summer, I'm determined to try to move beyond my ego, get over myself, and let go. Because, after all, to quote another old saying, I really have nothing to lose and everything to gain.
My name is Dennis Delaney, and my essay is entitled, Please No. In July of 1944, a dashing French aviator with the Free French Air Force disappeared on a reconnaissance mission in the Mediterranean. His name was Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. He was gifted, brave, and bold. Convinced that humanity needed to rise above itself, he wrote novels suffused with heroics. But it was a different tale by this warrior that touched the world and still does. It's called Le Petit Prince, The Little Prince. The story opens when a pilot crash lands in the middle of the Sahara Desert. There he meets a visitor from another planet whom he calls Le Petit Bonhomme, or the little kid, who tells the pilot he's from asteroid B612. Every chapter deals with the child's bafflement with the grande personne, the grown-ups. As he sees it, they don't understand much. Still, he believes there's hope, because every grown-up was once a little child, though not many of them remember that. At one point, the little kid asks the aviator, S'il vous plaît, dessine-moi un mouton. Please, draw me a sheep. The pilot struggles and struggles to draw a sheep until finally the little kid says he got it right. If this story were to be written in today's uncertain world, I think Saint-Exupéry might have Le Petit Bonhomme asking for a different drawing. Please, I can imagine him asking, draw me a little child. Then, behind the little child, draw me a big mushroom cloud. And next to the little child and the big mushroom cloud, write the words, please, no. A drawing of the little prince once appeared on the French 50-franc note. I wonder if this new drawing with little child, big mushroom cloud, and the words, please, no, would make a difference in today's grown-up discussions of centrifuges and enriched uranium. if the drawing were to appear on national flags around the world, starting with ours. Nothing ventured goes the old saying, so why not give it a try?
All too soon, our last group. Jay Craven, Susan Clark, Frank Bryan, Tom Blinkhorn, and Cindy Binninger.
There's a great deal on glasses at the Norwich bookstore. $6.95. And they're good. I recently marked 40 years spent producing film and the performing arts in Vermont. I treated myself to a massage, then a psychiatrist. Just kidding. Actually, I started the day by writing a fundraising letter about how the arts create moments of shared community that nourish us. I wrote about a ninth grader who said his first exposure to professional Shakespeare production showed him what it means to do something really well. I mentioned transcendent performances by Momix, Zap Mama, and Seraphic Fire that took $87,000 in donations to support this year's production costs, that we still needed $8,000 to stay in the black. I didn't mention how we'd start fundraising again in 3 weeks. I was running out of breath. There's a reason why Broadway theater is called That Fabulous Invalid. Fabulous is about the magic. Invalid is about the money. Don't tell him that I told you this, but when Kris Kristofferson walked into my house for rehearsal just 2 weeks before we started filming our $1.8 million movie Disappearances, I had just $28,000 in the bank. Yet we persist. We can see what's ventured. How can we measure what's gained? Our recent Pink Martini audience came from 96 towns. They thought they were coming for free drinks. But they stayed to enjoy the music. While in town, they pumped an estimated 2,300 gallons of gas, ate at six local restaurants, bought 64 bacon cheeseburgers, 46 Caesar salads, 12 bread puddings, and 73 gallons of beer, wine, and Vermont vodka. I'm told it enhances the experience of hearing a multilingual musical repertoire. But we also gained a measure of proof that our community still values something entirely ephemeral in this material world, that we take shared responsibility for the creation of these fleeting moments for ourselves and others, including our children, even when they belong to someone else, that we are still drawn to performances that do nothing more than leave feather-light impressions on our imagination and memory and on our collective soul. Something ventured, nothing gained.
I'm Susan Clark, and this is Venturing into Education Governance. A guy goes to his doctor with back pain. The doctor prescribes a heating pad. "A heating pad," says the patient. "Really? My mom always said to put ice on a sore back." "Ah," says the doctor, "and is your mom a physician?" "Because I had 4 years of pre-med, 4 years of medical school, and a five-year residency. And my mom always said to put a heating pad on a sore back." As I watched the education debate unfold this year, I thought of this doctor-patient scenario often, because it seemed that despite all the expertise in the room, it always came down to individual stories. For every study that showed the optimum district size in an urban area, there was another with a different finding about rural areas. We heard widely varying scenarios involving costs, geography, opportunity, and democracy. Kneecap tests were said to be unreliable in judging academic achievement. Links between poverty and education need more study. The unknowns go on and on. So the conversation would turn to one legislator's childhood in a small Vermont school, or another legislator's reflections on his mother's experience on a school board in suburban Pennsylvania, which brings us back to the patient with the sore back. For everyone I know with a back complaint, I've heard a different story of success or failure. Heat worked for some. For others, it was cold. Physical therapy, chiropractors, massage, injections, even surgery. The real answer is, it depends. And it would be tragic to leap into an irreversible surgery if a deftly applied heating pad would do the trick. Hopefully, this legislation will get people talking. Nothing ventured, nothing gained. But these conversations will be difficult and will require considerable courage. Vermonters need to be mindful that what's right for one community may be wrong for another. Every community will need to determine whether to retain its local decision-making board, merge into a regional board, or perhaps return to the legislature and say, "Sorry, Doc, we need another option."
Frank Bryan, it's still the same old story, fight for love and glory. During the winter of 1968, I'm working on my doctorate in Connecticut. But now I'm standing beside a black guy in a shower room in Springfield, Massachusetts, each of us stark naked. He'd won the fight, but we both took a beating, our blood mixing down the drain together. A year earlier, in another Golden Gloves tournament in Burlington, I'd won my first two fights against New Yorkers, but lost the championship to a Canadian. Now catching the other fighter's eye in that gym, I asked, "Why do we do this?" "Girls," he said with a grin. And here I'd been thinking it was all about pride and courage. Several years later, while teaching at Montana State, I tried what's often called the most dangerous sport in America, bull riding. Melissa and I agreed, two rodeos without winning, and I'd quit. The first week I drew Tarzan, Montana's bull of the year, for hurling cowboys to the ground. This isn't funny. "The good news," said my friend Jim, "Tarzan's tough, but usually won't turn on you if you're down." Strange audience. "Stay on Tarzan 8 seconds? No problem. 1001. Crash." Then came a week of primal fear. Riding bulls is not part of God's plan. Being crushed to death is. You can't call time out or beg for mercy. No helmet is allowed. The next week I drew, I swear to God, a bull named Danger. 1001, 1002, crash. I had doubled my time. But breaking my word would be no way to prepare Melissa for a marriage proposal. I'd ventured plenty. What did I gain? A life without fear? Not if you include snakes. Still, once long ago in Montana, I asked a lovely lady the very dangerous question, "Why do you love me?" "When I'm with you," she said instantly, "I always feel safe." 40 years have passed. The hour is late. Across the bedroom, there lies Melissa. The guy in the shower was right after all.
Tom Blinkhorn, my interview with Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir. In 1969, I was a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal, when that newspaper was one of the best in the country. It routinely financed reporters to take long assignments, domestic and foreign. I was assigned to do some reporting in North Africa, including Egypt, the Gulf countries, and Israel. I had a private interview with the first president of Tunisia, Habib Bourguiba. I reported on the status of the Aswan Dam, went down the Nile to the temples of Abu Simbel, wrote about them. And in Jordan, I managed to wangle a visit to a secret al-Fatah training camp, although I had to be taken at 4 a.m. by gunmen and put on the back of a truck, blindfolded, for a three-hour ride south of Amman. In Israel, Prime Minister Levi Eshkol had just died from a heart attack while he was still in office. And that touched off a frenzy of speculation about his replacement. One night at dinner, I asked an Israeli colleague who would replace him. Golda, he immediately replied without missing a break. But he added that she would not be giving any interviews until she was officially sworn in 2 days. I pressed him, could you get word that there's a reporter from the Journal in Milwaukee here where she lived, went to school, and actually taught school before going to Israel? He agreed to try, went to the phone. 10 minutes later, I've been invited to breakfast the next day with Golda at her house in Tel Aviv. But don't tell anyone, he told me, especially the New York Times. Around 7:30 the next morning, I was ushered without fanfare into a kitchen in a modest house in Tel Aviv, where Israel's famous Iron Lady, well before Margaret Thatcher, was pouring coffee and chain-smoking unfiltered Chesterfields. She peppered me with Milwaukee questions. Is North Division High School still there? Yes. Are socialists still running the Milwaukee City government? Yes. Eventually, I got around to asking her some questions about what it was like to be the first woman prime minister of Israel. And she gave me about a half hour. After my front page scoop, I was interviewed on radio and television, invited to speak at just about every synagogue in Milwaukee, and was given a $20 raise. Something ventured, and certainly something gained.
Cindy Bittinger, everything ventured without adequate support. As they have already done in medicine and law, women are now attempting to level the playing field with men in business. Now up to 32% of the class of 2016 at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth is made up of women, and Tuck has joined with Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, to offer a bridge program to prepare undergraduates for business experiences. Yet this particular playing field is full of rough spots. Today, successful business people are in a global world and on many tech platforms. They seem to be constantly on, meaning they're simultaneously multitasking to connect with employers, friends, family, and support systems most of the time. But despite the many challenges, most women need to work. More than 40% of all U.S. households with children under the age of 18 are supported solely or primarily by mothers. And if you add in moms not solely supporting the household, but still working, you get 70%. So you'd think we would do a better job of supporting their efforts to work. First of all, working mothers need a society that cares about children in general. Even if we're without children or with children who are grown, we deserve to live in communities that care for the very young as well as the very old. But daycare is barely regulated here, and daycare workers are mostly poorly paid. Governor Cunin, in researching this topic, found that the military has the best daycare system in the country. So we know what to do and how to do it.
when adequate funds are provided. Flex time and working from home should be offered by employers. Paid maternal leave should hold jobs open for women when they need to take time off to give birth and care for infants and toddlers. And finally, many older women will venture back into the workforce after their children have grown. And by giving support and encouragement to these accomplished, seasoned, and proven businesswomen, by easing their reentry instead of making it difficult, our society has much to gain.